Look, you start the music, we'll start the thing. Until then.
Until then, we're talking.
Right?
It's hangout time.
Not just a pretty face in front of the microphone, you know. Hi, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hi. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by all of you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
Wait, what's that thing we came up with? Oh, yeah, economy, tech, and culture, right? Oh, look, it's right here in the
rundown.
I should have just said that. We talk about economy, tech, and culture, and we connect the dots about the stories you see in the news every day, and we do it our way, I will say.
Our way, when they let us. We're talking with Ken.
Which is not often enough. Sorry.
Kai and I just wanted to talk all day, and they made us do a podcast. We're talking with Ken White this week about students and their First Amendment rights, about technology and advertising and its First Amendment rights, a whole host of things that are all too relevant today. Ken is a criminal defense attorney, and he's also the host of his own podcast called Make No Law.
Also, by the way, he tweets at Popat. I want to get that out there so you can look it up while you're listening to this podcast, because he is amazing. Also used to be a federal prosecutor, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, we got things to do. Here you go.
Oh, well, look, it's the news fix.
Where should we start, Mollywood?
The absolute best. I'm going to start by saying that the best welcome back tweet that I saw last week from people who were really excited that the show was back was somebody who said, I started whooping and hollering and jumping up and down when I heard the news fix music. And I was like, yes.
Then we made the right decision.
I know. They really pay attention.
We made the right decision.
Exactly. Anyway, I'm pretty sure I know what we're going to talk about
today.
Well,
then you go, because I have so many questions.
Oh, my God, yes. Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, the little data privacy story that mixes every conspiracy theory you could possibly hope for and then some with business and politics.
Right.
What's very interesting is that some of this reporting has been going on since at least 2015 about how a company called Cambridge Analytica, which is the U.S. arm of basically a very big political data firm, has been gathering millions of profiles from Facebook. In fact, around 2014, gathered some 50 million user profiles from Facebook by what appear to be totally allowable means on Facebook.
Right.
How it used them is up for debate later. But it used them in order to try to offer consulting services to political campaigns of Ted Cruz and Donald Trump in the U.S. To offer basically marketing suggestions and extremely targeted advertising.
To otherwise unsuspecting people who are on the social network, right? They get these ads stripped up and they're like, okay, here's an interesting ad. So I have
and TV, actually.
Oh, and TV. Okay. All right, good. So yeah. I have oh so very many questions.
Lay them on me.
Okay. Number one, and you alluded to this a little bit, is any of this illegal? Were any laws broken?
It does not appear that any laws were broken, actually. In fact, what's so interesting is that early stories, I think, were going to describe this as a data breach, and Facebook threatened to sue before the stories came out because they said it is not accurate to refer to it as a data breach, which is amazing. And that is primarily because what happened is that Facebook found out that these user profiles had been harvested in 2015, did not notify any users, and appears to have made only the barest of efforts to sort of try to track down the data or make sure it was deleted. Because before 2015, this was just how Facebook worked. If you were a third-party app and you could get people to install your app and take your quiz, which is what happened in the case of Cambridge Analytica, you had the right to not only harvest the data of the people who installed the app, but the data of all of their friends. And that's how you got from 270,000 people installing this app that was built by this Cambridge Analytica partner to them getting 50 million. It's like a fun little lesson in algorithmic growth.
Okay, so who's the sucker here? Is it Facebook for getting used by Cambridge Analytica? Is it Facebook users for so willingly and blindly and surrenderingly giving up their data? Or I mean, I don't even know who the sucker is.
Democracy?
Just kidding.
Just joking. It is unquestionably Facebook users, as it always is. Because let's be crystal clear. Every app that was using Facebook at this time had this access. They changed the way those apps work in about 2015 and reduced the amount of access. Mainly now they have to ask you permission if they want to access all the friend profiles. But some of them still ask to do that. And I'm sure that some users allow them to. They've probably limited the sheer scope of data. But this was how it worked, and this is how Facebook was enticing people to build apps for its platform so it would get more popular.
All right, so if this is how it's supposed to work, then, and there's only a teeny little bit of devil's advocate here, because I actually, this is a serious question. Why is everybody up in arms? This is the way social networks work.
People did not know that.
Why didn't they know that? Because they didn't dig into the 14 levels of Facebook privacy things, which we've talked about before, and how obtuse the company seemingly intentionally is about its privacy settings, or what?
Yeah, what you said. I mean, look, even if people knew, for example, that an app could like see your friends list, the idea I got in one of I never get in Twitter fights. I'm like really proud of this, but yesterday I was super crabby and I did. And only to the extent that we are well past the point, I think, of people who have known about this for a long time coming out and saying the users are the sucker because you should have known that this was happening. It's one thing to say, I knew that Facebook had access to my data and that apps could use my friends' data for some purpose. That what consumers should not reasonably, well, consumers should not reasonably be expected to read privacy policies that are hidden on purpose, right? That are really deliberately obscured so that you don't dig into them. They also shouldn't be expected to see the entire scope of an economic ecosystem developing in real time. Nobody knew that people were off in laboratories working on, you know, hyper-targeting as an advertising model that could be that, you know, would attempt to like jack into your brain and change the way you think.
Can we
like the level of usage is
right.
Sorry.
Well, yes. which is all fair. And I totally get that. Can we be clear about what data was scraped or hoovered up and what wasn't? Right. So it's not like they have my credit card and my social security number, but they do know whether I like to click on links of ponies and if I agree with, you know, some ad I saw out there. Right. That's what they've got.
It's just a small horse, a pony.
you're mixing up your segments, dude.
Call back to our loyal listeners. So this is not, and this is why it's sort of important, actually, to distinguish this from a data breach. It is not about gathering personal information that they can use for identity theft. It is about gathering personal information that they can use to profoundly understand your identity and your psychology. So they know the things you've liked. They know the things you comment on. They know, most likely your political leanings based on the things that you've liked and commented on and interacted with. They know all of the friends that you have and the friends of those friends.
Like literally, they know by name. I, Kai Rizdahl, have Mark Fernandez, a buddy from mine from college, as a friend. And he's got a friend whose name is Ray Benza, who whatever, right?
Yep. And then his friend and so on and so on and so on. Because really, I mean, that's how you go from, like, the math doesn't add up without that, right? You don't go from 270,000 to 50 million without friends, friends of friends, and friends of friends. And it's because if you think about the way that Facebook works, like, even if I deleted my data, all the record of my interactions would still be there. Facebook builds, as Zeynep Tufekci has pointed out so many times on our show and elsewhere, they build shadow profiles of people who don't even use Facebook based on conversations about those people by their friends who are on Facebook.
Yeah.
Like the web goes so deep that it was impossible. It's like asking a human to really understand what a billion is as a number. You know, like the web goes so deep that it's impossible to comprehend for people, except that advertisers and Facebook, when it tells its advertisers how powerful it is, totally get it.
Is there not some segment of the population that wants to be advertised to in this way? I don't want to see an ad for Mack trucks if I'm a Prius driver, right? I want to see an ad for granola, and I'm being pejorative here. I want to see an ad for granola and NPR tote bags.
I totally want to see an ad for Mack trucks.
Okay, well, you do, and you're a car person, right? And we know that.
Well, Ford F-150s mostly, so thank you. I'm sure that, you know, they heard that through my microphone, and I'll see one on Instagram.
Yeah, they're scraping this, right?
Apparently, they say they're not doing the microphone thing.
Yeah.
Sure, yes, right? This is in some ways the all-too-natural evolution of targeted advertising, and this is the economy, this is the economic engine that runs the entire internet, is targeted advertising. And it is inevitable, we did a story about this on Marketplace Tech, as they try to target that more and more and more, like, it's to the level, we talked to a woman who writes for Harvard Business Review, where you can place an ad on Facebook that only targets 20 people. And actually, That's like a floor. They raised the number because previously you could put an ad on Facebook that only targets one person who meets the specific criteria.
But how is that possibly worth your time, money, and energy?
It depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to sell something, if you're trying to sway an election, right? Because that is the claim that Cambridge Analytica was making.
Right. We should be clear here, by the way, that we're piling on Facebook because Facebook is the one with all the data, right? And Cambridge Analytica, which is in a lot of ways a really terrible company, as has been seen by these Channel 4 exposés over in the UK, and there's another one dropping today. We're concentrating on Facebook because Facebook is the one who has the data, and that's the one that everybody logs on to see the pictures of their high school roommates, you know, now college-age kids or whatever, right?
Yeah. My sort of hyperbolic metaphor for this was that data is a weapon, right? Data is a weapon that can be used in all kinds of ways at this point, and Facebook is the world's biggest arms dealer.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Thank you.
That's a good one. I like that. That's very good.
I was pretty proud of that.
Yeah, no, you're
but
totally
really,
sure.
When these researchers who were working with Cambridge Analytica, when they were like, okay, we're developing this technology for hyper-targeting, for what's called psychographic advertising, the idea that it's like it reads your mind because it understands your personality, it was really hard and expensive to get all that data. And then they thought, what is like the Federal Reserve of the data that we need here? It's Facebook. And Facebook, like DGAF, about protecting our data. And so it just becomes, turns out you can get the E without the E.
I know, right? We'll see what happens. Well, let me ask you a question along those lines. And then I think we have other stuff we need to talk about. Along the lines of DGAF, do you suppose Mark Zuckerberg now understands exactly how deep the pile of doo-doo that he's in is?
No. Come on.
Seriously?
Do you think that?
I don't. I'm gobsmacked that we're now going on 72 hours in this story, and you've heard bupkis from Zuckerberg, who has his own issues, right? But also Sheryl Sandberg, who in theory is savvy about these things. And you're like, where are you?
Yep. Not a peep. Not a peep. And I don't think we're going to hear one unless they are compelled. Now they're being compelled to testify in the UK, but to what end? I will say what I do think is a big development that happened right before we started recording this is that the Washington Post did report that the FTC is opening an investigation into what happened here because Facebook, remember, had to sign a consent decree with the FTC back in 2011 because they violated our privacy so many times that said, if you don't notify users and get their permission before you share their data beyond basically the privacy settings they've already set, then you could be subject to fines of $40,000 per incident.
And 40,000 times 50 million is a boatload of money. Let me ask you a question.
That might get his attention.
Right,
maybe.
Maybe. Mandy Shoger from TWSP, Washington, which I love, actually, TWSP. She wants to know, actually, what she could do. She says, and here's the quote, "The idea that individuals can be micro-targeted with specific ads that no one else can see is somehow very spooky. Please, kind Molly, provide me some glimpse of hope in this story of gloom. Is there any way to fight back against these forces?" ? End of quotes. And my caveat on this answer, Ms. Wood, is you cannot say, oh, just get off Facebook.
I will not, because frankly, that won't help.
Right.
Because see previous regarding all of the data that they have. See above in our rundown. All data that they have already gathered about you and the profile that, you know, and that has probably been shared. You know, there was a story this week that said that because so many apps were using Facebook data in this way, your data has, and the data on your friends and your friends and friends and friends and friends, has probably already been shared with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of different apps.
Honest to gosh, last thing, and then I think we got a boogie. Is this a tipping point?
I hope so. Look, we have a producer, our new senior producer, Eve Tro, is in our control room, and you're going to see her start laughing right now.
She's literally laughing. Yep. This is like, where's the closed circuit camera?
She knows exactly what I'm about to say right now, and that is GDPR. I am obsessed with the general data.
Oh. Right.
Protection regulation that is in the process of going into effect in Europe that includes consumers' rights, only EU citizens at this point, right? But consumers' rights to know what data companies are collecting about them, to see that data and to ask for it to be removed.
Right.
And I think that is going to force even companies in the United, I know so, we've done several interviews to this effect, that is going to force companies in the US to change the way they do business on some level. And should anybody want to take up this cause in our Congress could provide a blueprint for how to force Facebook to forget about me. It's one thing for me. I can't delete my data right now. It's not enough. Like, for me to delete my Facebook page doesn't make Facebook forget me. And that's what I want. And that is the answer to Mandy's question on some level, is that, no, we actually do need help. We need the government to force these companies to let go of our data. And that's all we got.
Have you met the Congress of the United States? I'm just, you know. I'm just asking.
Well, that's, you know, I'm not saying it's a hopeful answer. It's just something.
All right.
Let's move on to your area of expertise, because I have been talking for so long now.
You go.
Last week, we were totally talking about your interview with the three famous guys.
Big Adventure. Kai's Big Adventure. That's right.
Timothy Geithner, Hank Paulson, and Ben Bernanke. Kai's Big Adventure to the snowy east.
Yes.
And at the studio he apparently loves more than ours.
I do, but it's really nice.
And we were riffing on this idea of what it would mean to be behind closed doors trying to save the economy, not being able to involve people. And so did you ask my question?
I kind of did. I didn't do it exactly that way, but I did. At one point, I turned to Hank Paulson, and I asked, who used to be the Secretary of the Treasury, rather. And I asked him about his regrets over the past 10 years since the crisis. And here's what he said.
As tough as it was during the crisis, in the crisis, you know, you're playing offense, and so you really don't have time a lot of time to be scared or to feel sorry for yourself. But I remember, you know, after the crisis, you know, all the criticism, and then seeing, I don't know how I read the poll right, but there was a poll that came out, and as I read it, you know, that the TARP was more, you know, less popular than torture. And so I looked at it and said, we'd worked so hard. We had done something that had pulled the country back, I think, from the abyss. But I realized you're never going to get credit for, you know, preventing a crisis that people don't see. And the fact that we never were able to, and I never was able to make the connection between what it is this financial system does for the average American, and if the system doesn't work, how that's going to impact the average American, and that we weren't doing this for Wall Street. And so that's, to me, my biggest regret by far.
It's tough, right? Coming from a guy who used to run Goldman Sachs to say, no, it's not about Wall Street. But my takeaway from an hour around the table with those three guys is that that's their big regret, that, you know, they had the fear, they had the panic, and they couldn't make everybody understand how serious it was. That was my takeaway.
That's so interesting, because as I was listening to that, I felt like it was sort of like data and privacy. Like, people don't, you can never get people to understand a hypothetical.
Right.
You know, and you can never get them to understand something that almost happened but didn't, because it didn't happen. And yet here they are now with this like total PTS. So that there's...
Well, it's so funny you mentioned that, because what happened was, the setting for this thing was that they had just been in a day and a half long conference, the three of them, with a bunch of people they went through the crisis with, people from Treasury and New York Fed and the Federal Reserve. And Geithner walked in the room literally as we were starting, and we were chit-chatting and this and that, and, you know, the first thing Bernanke did was walk in and say, where's the men's room? But anyway, so Ben went down to take a pee, and Geithner was like, yeah, I think I have a little PTSD from a day and a half of talking about this stuff. So clearly that's what they're going through. It's really interesting. Yeah.
They're foxhole buddies at this point. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we have this, we should say, this is a big deal, this interview. And I'm just going to do this on behalf of Kai, because I know he does not like to self-promote. But if you would like to hear the whole interview, we're running it in parts on Marketplace. I think sections one and two have aired, three and four will air later this week. And by the end of the week, the whole thing will be online. But you can kind of skip ahead if you want and read the transcript.
Yeah, that is true. That is marketplace.org is where you find that.
Which is not unlike watching the movie all over again. I know, I just keep coming back to it.
Oh, Too Big to Fail? Yeah.
But it really, I almost want to, much like I want to see The Darkest Hour and Dunkirk as like a double feature, because I didn't realize they were both about the same thing. I want to watch this movie and read the transcript like all in the same day. It's fascinating.
Glutton for punishment. Anywho.
We would love your thoughts. I know it doesn't sound like a fun day. Maybe that's a whiskey day. The Dunkirk and Darkest Hour one, not the
whiskey. Jesus Christ. Man, okay.
I'm going to stop talking.
How about a nice cup of tea? How about a cuppa?
What do you think about a cuppa and a bunch of war movies? Please email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Or you can leave us a comment, like so many of you do. We get a lot of comments through our website, makemesmart.org. Or you can tweet us at Kai Rizdahl or at Mollywood.
Coming up next, Ken White, First Amendment lawyer and a super smart guy.
As you know, thousands of students across the country walked out of their classrooms last week. It was part of a national campaign to remember last month's shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. It was also a call for stricter gun laws. And we actually caught up with some students in Los Angeles, where Kai is, at Burbank High School. For the walkout, 17 students stood silently at the center of their quad for 17 minutes, representing each life lost in the shooting. 2,000 of their other students joined them while that happened. And here's what they told us about it.
I remember seeing so many people all around the courtyard, all over every floor, just staring at us. And I felt speechless because I expected no one to show up.
And it just gave me chills when I looked back and read each name every minute.
And it was a really exhilarating feeling to know that we were being watched.
It shows how powerful we actually are and that what we do does actually matter. Like being somebody's friend, being kind in general, making sure somebody else is okay, making sure that if you see someone sitting alone, you go up to them. Because when we were all together for that 17 minutes, I was kind of thinking, why can't we always be like this?
So that was Sophia Alexis right there, Chloe Quattro also, and Noel Bravo.
And they said that, and this is kind of upsetting, that all students today mm-hmm. need to have some fear of guns at school. We should say that as we are recording this, right this minute, there is a developing story about a shooting in Maryland at a high school. It sounds like a student gunman has been killed and two others have been injured. That story will obviously change by the time that we're done recording this, but this sadly just does not stop being relevant minute by minute. So we asked the students what they need to feel safe at school. Noelle said a little more on that.
What would keep us safe is definitely gun control, but it's also knowing about guns, knowing how to maybe tape a wound together to make sure the bleeding stops.
Wow, seriously?
Knowing that you need to be a leader and say, okay, everybody do this just in case your teacher's in shock.
That's nutty. So you know what's freaky is having teenage boys and trying to get them to engage on this and having them just go,
meh. Yeah. I heard a thing about teachers. My sister-in-law is a teacher in, you know, Oakland Public Schools. My son goes to them. It's you think about what we ask teachers to do at a moment when so many of the mm-hmm. teachers are striking to get raises that, you know, top out at 5%, and then we're asking them to be human shields for mm-hmm. our kids. It's the reality that kids and teachers are dealing with literally as we're speaking right now. It's horrifying.
March 14th, that walkout that a lot of students did across the country in high schools, many, many, many thousands of them. March the 24th is the more formal March for Our Lives. People around the country, again, marching for an end to gun control and for gun control. Let me rephrase that. And March 24th is the March for Our Lives. People around the country marching for an end to gun violence and also more specifically mass shootings in schools.
And that and the March 14th walkout got us thinking a lot about students' rights and free speech rights specifically. So enter Ken White, our guest, who's going to walk us through that. You know, things are particularly murky around what kids can discuss, what they can do, what happens on social media. Ken, as Kai mentioned, is a criminal defense attorney. He's a partner at Brown, White & Osborne. He is a writer on First Amendment law and the host of the new Make No Law podcast, which is like such a cool name. It explores some of America's most important. It just sounds so cool. Make
that
no
all, you know.
Law. Turns out the Constitution had some, you know, towering writing in it.
turns out. Breaking.
Maybe it was only the amendments. I'm just saying, like, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it explores some of America's most important First Amendment cases. We talked to him also about speech online and free speech as it relates to advertising, which is also quite relevant. Just a really interesting conversation all around. Spoiler, there's a swear also. Here he is, Ken White.
I want to ask you, first of all, can kids just get up and walk out of class? Are they allowed to do that, Mr. First Amendment lawyer?
No.
all right.
So everyone's been talking about this, but even under the most forgiving pro-kid free speech cases, like Tinker.
Right, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right. Schools have the right to prevent or punish substantial disruption. And I think pretty much everyone would agree that getting up and walking out in the middle of the class is going to be treated as substantial disruption. So whether the school decides to do something about it is another question.
Okay, so give me the 30 seconds on Tinker v. Des Moines, which is, I guess, the case now on school disruption and student rights, right?
Well, it's the high water mark
for
student rights. So 1969, Mary Beth Tinker decides that she wants to wear a black armband to school to protest escalation in Vietnam. And the school has prohibited it, so she goes and she gets suspended. Her parents sue. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court says is you just can't punish kids for expression at school unless you show that they've caused a substantial disruption to the school. So just not liking it is not enough.
You actually talked to Mary Beth Tinker on your podcast, right?
I got to interview Mary Beth Tinker for my new podcast, which is called Make No Law, and it basically explores the history and people behind important First Amendment cases. And she's kind of a personal hero, so it was an amazing experience to speak with her because I suggested, hey, maybe kids these days don't really care. And she came back hard. You know, she travels the country as an activist for youth rights, and she said they very much care. And her thought was that what you hear today, that kids are just astroturf, that they're not themselves sincerely involved in protests, they're being put up to it. She said, that's the same thing people said about me 50 years ago. And it's not true then, and it's not true now.
So on some level, and this did surprise me, actually, because I thought that there was a whole thing about minors versus adults. This landmark case did essentially find that students have some First Amendment rights, though, right?
Yes. The famous line is that students don't leave their rights at the schoolhouse gates.
Yeah.
And the question is, how many rights and what is disruption?
Right. That seems like a nicely broad question of what is disruption, right?
Well, over the last 50 years, the court's deference to school administrators about what is disruption has grown.
Hmm.
So I don't think you'd see Tinker come out quite the same way you did in 1969, because I think courts are a lot more inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to administrators just sort of saying, well, this is disruptive, and not making them offer too much proof.
Do school districts get themselves in trouble if, as my school district did, they made adjustments to allow the kids to have some space to protest, right? I think in my school district, they extended a recess and set aside an area on campus, and they said, here, you can do it here, but by implication, not over there and not at that time.
Well, they don't get in trouble yet. So for kind of using a judo move to take the energy of the kids and harness it and direct it, that's maybe smart, and that's not illegal. And, you know, they can still guide where the kids and when the kids can protest. Where they're going to run into problems is the next time some kids want to protest and they say no. So the problem is going to be viewpoint discrimination. When they've established that for this issue, a bunch of kids wanted to protest and they encouraged it and you know, went along with it, let them do it to some extent. And when some other kids want to protest for some other issue, perhaps one not as popular, and are told no, those are the ones who have a case.
Right. Can we talk for a minute about social media? Because that's where a lot of the expression that students make these days comes. Schools are clearly interested in what those kids have to say on social media. There are possibilities of threats and you know, electronic disruption, as it were. Is there a test case? Is there a line?
This is the cutting edge. So this is the battlefront in the area of student First Amendment rights. Traditionally, the schools, you know, they have control over you while you're at school.
Right.
The school can't stop you from marching on Saturday or leafleting on Sunday. But social media blurs those lines, because when kids are, you know, bullying another kid from school or harassing a teacher or whatever it is on social media, that starts to impact what happens at school. So case after case across the country, there's this dispute over when can schools punish kids for conduct on social media directed at other kids from school or teachers or administrators.
Can we quickly pivot to the tech industry, actually? Yeah. Can we just take a little hard,
no, let's,
hard turn?
There's lots there that you and I, Molly, have talked about, as you know. And I maybe Ken's going to be like the actual arbiter here. I don't know. We're going to see.
I know. I'm very curious about this. So there is obviously a lot of conversation now about bots, manipulation, advertising on tech platforms, be it, you know, with intent to sow division or just be horrible, like the Snapchat ad that let users choose whether to slap Rihanna or punch Chris Brown. Are advertisements protected speech?
They are, with a but. So there's a category of speech called commercial speech that has somewhat lower First Amendment protection. It can be regulated more than non-commercial speech. The exact details are a long, boring slog.
That's why I never went to law school.
But yes, you can regulate advertising somewhat more than you can regulate opinion, for instance.
When we talk about regulating social media, right, there's the expression, there's the user, I suppose, right? And then there is the platform itself. And I will, and this is a little bit unfair because you didn't know I was going to do it, but I'm going to pull up a tweet of yours from a while ago. When was it? Beginning of March. And you were on one of the rants that you get on Twitter as your followers, and I encourage you to follow Ken at Popat. He's great. And I'm going to read it to you, and we'll get that expletive because it's coming. Here we go. The entire concept that we should have the government regulate Google and YouTube and Twitter and Facebook to protect free speech is absolutely fucking moronic, and I refuse even to pretend to take it seriously. How come?
Sure. So right now, there's this complaint that a lot of social media platforms like Twitter and YouTube and Google are censoring speech. A lot of the time, this complaint comes from the right. The perception is, not terribly unreasonably, that these platforms are more left-leaning and they censor more of right-leaning expression. So some people are saying that we should treat them like common carriers, that we should regulate them. They should be treated like true public spaces. Because, you know, the baseline is a private company doesn't have to let you speak on its platform.
Right.
Why I'm saying this is crazy is that, first of all, to quote Mitt Romney, you know, corporations are people too, my friend. And these platforms, these people, they have rights, and one of their rights is to have the type of platform they want to have, whether it's, you know, a Nazi festival or not. Yeah. They might want to have family friendly. They might want to have it comfortable. They might want to have it, you know, all nicey-nicey in a way some people may not appreciate, but that's part of their speech, the way they want to frame their expression network. So the idea that the government should regulate and make sure that they do some sort of, you know, fairness doctrine where everyone gets equal speech is nonsense. It's nonsense in the way I don't think we should trust the government to do that. And the other thing is it basically pretends that these platforms don't themselves have rights, that they don't have an interest in running a type of platform, a type of expression the way they do. But they do have that right.
Well, so interestingly, there is legislation afoot just now that's passed the House, the FOSTA Act, which is ostensibly a bill to attempt to stop sex trafficking and advertisements for sex trafficking. That would chip away at that protection, the idea that platforms cannot be held liable for things that people post, which is a pretty landmark part of the Communications Decency Act and part of the reason we have, you know, the internet that we have today. But I think we're starting to see encroachments on that.
Absolutely.
In which these platforms, right? Is that fair to say?
And that type of encroachment is like the type of encroachment I just said that I strongly disagree with.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
you're talking about law that would cut back on what's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And what that says basically is your platforms can't be treated as the speaker when a commenter or a Facebook user or something like that puts that something up. That's not their speech. They can't be sued for defamation. They can't be sued for sex trafficking or whatever it is, for an advertisement. It's not on them. What this law is, the first chip out of that, saying, well, except for ads that we say are about sex trafficking, now you're liable for what's on your platform. The reason for a law like that is not necessarily that you're going to lose a case down the road, that someone's going to sue Facebook for defamation and win. It's that a million people are going to sue Facebook for defamation and collapse it. It's the number of cases. It's the way the system works, not the validity of any particular case.
And then what about the argument that these platforms are, let's be honest with ourselves, publishers at this point, or at least some of them are, that Facebook has enough editorial manipulation, that there's a distinction without a difference, and that publishers have different rules from platforms?
Well, you still treat their publications like publications, but not the comments on them. So under Section 230 in this whole area of law, a platform like anything as humble as my blog, I'm responsible for the content of a post I put up, but I'm not legally responsible for the comments in response to it. So it's fine when Facebook publishes to treat it as a publisher, but we still shouldn't be in the business of regulating the comments.
Since we have you in the chair, there is a question we ask everybody that we get on this podcast, and it goes like this. What is something you thought you knew, but it later turned out you were wrong about?
I thought I knew that there was a consensus, a broad American consensus about rights that we all agreed on, that we all held in common, that we all thought was part of our American heritage. And I've kind of come to realize that there really isn't that consensus, or that it's very spotty, that rights that are perfectly well established in law, that you can get a judge to recognize in a minute, if you put them to someone, they'll think, well, that shouldn't be the law, or that shouldn't be a right, or, I don't care, or it doesn't apply here, or whatever it is. That the process of defending rights like the First Amendment is not something where you get to sit down after a day well done. You have to keep fighting every day.
So that was Ken White. He is, I should say, actually, the disclaimer is that Ken and I know each other in real life. So just take that for what it's worth. But the podcast, which I recommend you check out, is called Make No Law. And you can follow him on Twitter, and he blogs as well, at Popat.
Make No Law.
Make No Law. Congress Shell.
It's like anyway. An action movie podcast title. Okay. About the First Amendment. Next
really?
Up,
you
your thoughts on last week's show. I watch a lot of action movies.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, time for you.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
Lots and lots of you wrote in about last week's episode. George McKee from Houston, around Houston, the Houston area, has his own thoughts about reaching the 10-year mark of the fall of Bear Stearns. He says, quote, "We're back to the level we were at before, but will we ever make up the lost ground of growth that we would have had if the crisis had not occurred?" No, George, we won't.
Really?
Yeah, no.
Not even with like compound interest and stuff? Darn it.
No.
Sucks, no. You know, it's kind of like my prime earning years. Yeah. Anyway, if that is the least that happened to me, I am grateful. Yes. And I'm telling you that now because I've been listening to all these stories that we're putting together. It's brutal. Michael Coleman left us this message about our interview with Ai-Jen Poo of the National Domestic Workers Alliance.
There was discussion about how certain sectors of the economy do not have workers' protections. I noticed that no one discussed how these sectors were purposefully excluded from workers' protections. She mentioned factory work, but at that time those laws were being passed. Southern Democrats were a very strong voting bloc, so jobs that were majority white and male were covered, but jobs that were majority black and female were not. That's why home help and agriculture workers were excluded. I wish she would have expanded on the purposeful exclusion of certain workers and how these exclusions have allowed workers in these sectors to continue to be exploited. Thank you.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, we did talk, I guess, a little bit about the racial part of it and about the gender part of it. But, those are totally fair points. I get that.
Yep, absolutely.
Rebecca Eklund from Baltimore had a question about how these issues surrounding social media like Cambridge Analytica are raising some ethical, you might say, questions.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Rebecca from Baltimore. And I am so glad you're back because I have missed you both. And my question for Molly has to do with the fact that I teach ethics at a university. And whenever I teach ethics, I teach a short unit on social media technologies. So I'm wondering what you see as the most pressing ethical issues in social media and in technology in general. Thanks so much for making me smart.
I got mine, but you get to go first. You're the expert.
All right. Also, I love that because I just saw Book of Mormon, which now Kai and I have both seen, and it reminded me of that song where he's like, but mostly me. She missed us both, but mostly me.
But mostly me. Yeah, anyway.
Is actually a wonderful thread. Rebecca, I'm glad you brought that up. I was just, hopefully I'll find a way to put it on our website, by Jonathan Zunger, who wrote this great thread about how computer science is a field which hasn't yet encountered consequences, that we're starting to, but we are not incorporating ethics broadly into the conversations, into the curriculum of computer science. So like once in a while, there might be a discussion of ethics on social media, but there's not, you know, if you go to journalism school, you have to take an ethics class. Chemistry and physics had ethical reckonings, according to his thread, with, you know, first dynamite and then chemical weapons and then the atomic bomb. And ethics is now a part of those conversations. And it's not a baked-in part. So there's not even like one ethical question. It's more, why are we not teaching that when we talk about computers?
All right, so I've got a corollary, which is along the same lines, I just think it's about companies doing the right thing, right? I mean, you don't have to be taught that letting people scrape your data is just an icky, icky thing to do, right? And I think it's about corporate awareness of their responsibility in society, which to some is a heretical statement. That's my thought.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would argue that it's all been, if your imperative is growth— Like, don't you also have to be taught not to give people subprime mortgages or...
Yeah, totally.
You know,
totally.
Charge poor people.
It's not just social media and tech. It's getting it back to Ben Bernanke and Tim Geithner and Hank Paulson, right? It's companies not doing stupid things that they know are going to blow up in the pursuit of profit.
Yeah, but they will all do that in the pursuit of profit. So the question is, like, how explicitly do they have to be taught along the way?
There's another song coming. You've got to be taught. Anybody see South Pacific? You've got to be carefully taught. And it was referenced in Hamilton, by the way.
Amazing.
It was. It totally was.
Anyway, yes, I think we just have to be. I was just saying this to somebody, like the tech industry is only about, you know, I consider the modern tech industry to have been born in about 2007, same age as my son. And when I think about how explicit I have to be with him, like this is how you wash your hair.
Wait till he's 16, like, man. It's all going to go downhill.
Well, I know, right? But wait till the tech industry is 16.
That's what I'm saying, by extension, right? Wait till tech turns 16.
Which is why right now we have to be like, be nice to people. You have to scrub your hair with your fingernails. Don't break democracy. Like, you just have to be super explicit and have the authority and the laws, the rules to back it up.
I have nothing to add because that was brilliant. And poetry. And poetry.
Scrub your hair with your fingernails. If you like this show, if you liked the poetry and the singing and the musical references and the interviews and all of the things that are a part of this magical experience we call Make Me Smart, please tell your friends. And if this is the first time you heard us, subscribe on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Google Play. We're all over the place. And please leave us a rating, leave us a comment wherever you subscribe.
Oh, and we're on Spotify too. Man, we're everywhere.
We are.
We are everywhere.
I listen on Spotify.
We're nowhere though without the music though. That's all I'm saying. There you go. Look, man, you know, come on. Let's break that
fourth
wall.
Damn, that was good timing.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Shara Morris, Christopher Olin, and senior producer Eve Tro, who's sitting there shaking her head in the control room. I can see it through the glass. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
Little did they know that their bass line would prove to be so comedically brilliant, too. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
All right, there we go. Got nothing else to say.
Burp-pew. I have so many things to say.
Do you?
No.
You should just go out with the poetry. You should just leave it there. Had a guy tweet at me, by the way, the other day about where was the double speed version of this piece of music.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too. We need a SoundCloud of this music and the tech music.
Maybe next week.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.